Welcome to the Tales of Osteopathy Students with me, Chelsea Irma, good friend B. How are you doing, B?
Hello, hello. I'm all good. I'm officially an old lady. I've been told today that I have deteriorating hearing, so that's fun. I'll get my little crochet and tenor ladies pad out now, shall I?
Well, I mean, you can crochet like little hammocks for your plants.
Yeah.
And... you know, make little hats for everyone for Christmas and stuff like that. It's not all a loss.
I'm not that sort of grandma. I'm the sort of like cheating in a poker game sort of grandma.
You so are. 100%.
Whiskey in like my hot cocoa or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. I can see it. I can see the future.
Yeah. Easy. Oh, God. Anyways, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm feeling, I've got one annoyingly slightly hungover after having two whole glasses of wine.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what happens when you get old, like me, that suddenly you just can't even have one glass of wine without suffering the consequences.
I don't even drink wine anymore. I had one bad experience with red wine when I was like 15 or 14, which can I just shout out to my like childhood best friend Ellie, because I still think she's one of the best friends that I've ever had for what she did with me when I was extremely drunk off drinking a bottle and a half of red wine on my own.
When you were 14?
Yeah. Why did I think that was
you
a good
animal.
Idea? At school as well. Woohoo, rebel.
Goodness.
Yeah.
These bloody boarding schools.
I know. What a wanker.
Hey.
What a wanker.
So what have you been up to this week, V, apart from getting your ears tested?
Well, we've had our tiny little brains blown. We record on a Monday and have... at university on a Saturday and Sunday, so we're sort of on a little spiral down from how much we've had to process. And Chelsea and I are both doing the online absolute social distancing to the max because we're in our beds doing our work over Zoom and Microsoft Teams and stuff like that. So we've just been enjoying those comforts, but also it means that you don't move all day. And my brain just went to absolute shite. Like it was a pool of goo at the bottom of my skull yesterday.
Yeah, I know what you mean. By the end of the day, I was just like, I don't know, I need some air on my face or something. I did just open the window in front of me, just like, give me outside nature. And my boyfriend's been away quite a lot this week, so I've been generally on my own, just like doing all my stuff from home. Apart from, you know, and teaching people yoga online, having a bit of a chat. But apart from that, I haven't really seen many humans. And there's been a squirrel that's been turning up outside my window, and I've been chatting to said squirrel, and I know that he hates squirrels.
I don't like them. They're the same way that people feel about rats, but to me, squirrels are just flying rats. They're so unpredictable. They will actually attack you without any remorse. They don't care.
Hey V, how many times have you been bitten by a squirrel?
Once. I actually was bitten once. That's all it takes. I don't trust them. They can sense the fear in my eyes. They just know it.
It was last year. So when we were in our first year at uni, we'd gone to get some lunch and we were walking back and you were literally just telling me about how a squirrel had bitten you once. And then this other squirrel just started running towards you.
They can sense it. It's so fucking weird. And we've all got grey squirrels in England because they fucking killed all the red squirrels. Like, I'm sure red squirrels aren't any better. So if I were to go up to Scotland and actually see one, I would still be scared. But they're little murderous villains. They are. In tiny little hairy bodies. It's just gross.
I love squirrels. I think they're great.
No! The thing is, I like love snakes, spiders, tarantulas, like any sharks, all that sort of stuff. Fantastic. Love it. They're so interesting. They're so clever. Good on you. But squirrels, pigeons, I don't think so. I do not think so.
The things that are very native to everywhere that we live in the UK.
Yeah, yeah. One of them.
You're like, get me to Australia with the snakes, the sharks and the spiders.
They're so much more interesting. even though they could actually kill me. Pretend.
Well, if a squirrel bites you in the wrong place.
Exactly. Exactly. Who knows? Femoral artery. Going for the goods.
I mean, that would have to be like a very strategic squirrel to get.
Well, they're like that, Chelsea. They're like that. They
are. So now that we've given everyone a complex about squirrels.
Yeah.
What have you got snacks and tea-wise today?
I've been a fancy, fancy bitch. And after my hearing test, I was like, I'm getting old. So I went into Waitrose, like all of the other old, rich people. I do not belong in there. I was like in my trackies, in my hoodie, with my mask on. And I was like, ooh, look at me in Waitrose. But I've got a raw green virgin smoothie. Don't know why it's a virgin. Smoothies don't tend to have alcohol in them, do they? It's got kiwi, pear, kale, spinach, broccoli, apple and vitamin C. It's very delicious. And nice. Chelsea has just seen me devour a lot of dumplings and bao buns in one go.
You're all about those dumplings and bao buns at the moment.
They're really just so, so good. And I do have a little bit of carrot cake next to me. Not gonna lie.
Oh,
it's a healthy morning for me.
So want cake.
What have you got to drink, me? Which is
so. I've just had a Bounty tea, which, dear listener, if you haven't heard me talk about this before, it's the fucking best tea.
So good.
It's essentially a black tea, but it's got like roasted coconut shavings in it. It's got bits of chocolate. It's got like these blue corn flowers, and oh, hot damn, it is tasty. Tell you, it's beautiful. Beautiful. And I don't have any snacks, but. Because, so I had this little jar that I normally keep on my desk that I normally fill up with like some like nuts.
Have you eaten all of those already?
I haven't eaten all of it. I'm being very strict with myself. But essentially, it's normally just a little jar. It's like an old peanut butter jar, right? And I went to this shop called Scoop, which is, you know, does what it says on the tin. It's like, you know, refill center, whatever. You just scoop it into a little paper bag.
Love it. Please, can we have more?
Indeed. And I got a little bit carried away. And I got too many different things. And I ended up having to fill a 2 litre jar with everything I bought. It cost over £20 for everything that I got. Like it was ridiculous. I had like dark chocolate covered hazelnuts and Brazil nuts. And then I had like pecans and pistachios and cranberries and crystallised ginger, some sour cherries. Like I fucking went for it. I went for it. And over the weekend, obviously study weekend, I ate quite a lot. And so I'm being very strict with myself that I don't eat a £20 jar of snacks within 3 days.
When you're studying, though, it's you're literally like a bottomless pit for food and drink.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had about, I always have tea in pint forms. I think I had 8 pints of tea yesterday. So that's 16 normal cups of tea. So I don't blame you if you did eat all of them.
Yeah. But that I'm just trying to comprehend the amount of tea that your body consumed.
It's not all caffeinated. Not that that makes it better, but...
That's still good, though. I'm genuinely quite impressed.
Yeah. My skin looks lovely, so...
That's amazing.
Fluid. Hydrated. You got a really interesting A&P to tell me this week. This is one of my faves.
I do. It's one of my faves. And we've touched on it. I think we've alluded to it a little bit over the previous weeks.
Yeah.
That I've been a big fan. You're also a big fan. It's our buddy, our old friend, our old pal. The lymphatic system.
Woo! Woo, woo, woo.
The crowd goes wild. Yeah. We know you've all been itching to know about this.
The lymph is itching, so itching, cool, itching. Though. It's so cool.
It's bloody cool. Bloody cool. So, also, whilst I was doing some of my research, one of the things that someone said about the lymphatic system, which I think highlights it perfectly, it's the unsung hero of anatomy.
I'd agree.
Absolutely.
Nobody talks about it. Nobody actually understands it properly.
I think the main thing that when people hear the word lymph, they hear about lymph nodes and in regards to cancer treatment, I think, it's like, has it spread to the lymph nodes? And most people are like, what the fuck is a fucking lymph node? Well, you're about to find out because I'm going to tell you all about it.
Settle in. Buckle up. Pull up your socks. Get a cup of tea. Let's go.
Yeah. So, the lymphatic system has three main functions. The first one is it returns fluid to the heart.
Sorry.
The second...
I'm about to crack up because I thought you said functions. And I was like, what is a function?
What's a function?
Sorry, carry on. I'll try and contain my immature giggling.
You're all good. So the first one being it returns fluid to the heart. The second one is that it assists large molecules in entering the blood, such as like hormones and lipids and stuff. And the third one is the immune surveillance. And I love the term surveillance. It's just like there's like CCTV all over your body. Watching stuff. And also your lymphatic system is made up of various different components. One of those things being lymph. I just love the word lymph.
Yeah, it is satisfying to say, isn't it? Lymph.
Mm. It means clear water in Latin.
Ooh. Mm. Maybe your clinic should be called Lymph.
I'll keep it on the list. I was actually talking to Jack about that yesterday, my partner Jack, about what should I call my clinic? My surname is Rickson, and he said it should be Fixum Rickson.
Oh, I like it. I like it. It's like Bob the Builder, but more mature.
Yeah, ready it's for almost business. Like you can see one of those American adverts. It's like, hey, your back's hurting, don't worry, fix and rix him. A little niggle in your knee, hey, fix and rix
him. I'm sorry, but you know what I mean? TM right here, never you take it. Not that it's a common surname, but for sure trademarked.
Lymphatic system components. You've got your lymph, you've got your lymphatic vessels, which is where it travels through, and you've got your lymph nodes, which we'll talk a little bit more about shortly. And also you've got some organs as well, which is your spleen, your thymus, your adenoids and your tonsils.
Lovely.
Yes. So the lymphatic system is essentially your second circulatory system. So your primary circulatory system being your blood, which we haven't really talked a lot about yet, but it's coming soon. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a quick overview just so it makes a little bit more sense in terms of how the lymph works with it. So we've got arteries that generally carry oxygenated blood away from the heart and veins that generally carry deoxygenated blood back to the heart. I say generally because there are a few exceptions which we will come to at a later date. Now, as the arteries go through the body, they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until they get to their smallest point, which is where they are arterioles. And the smallest veins are called venules. These link together to form these things called capillaries. Capillaries are super teeny tiny. They're only one cell thick, and this is the place where things like oxygen and fluid exchange take place. So where all of that, you know, nutrients, all the good stuff gets into your tissues. So yeah, so because of this really high pressure, this is how all the oxygen and the nutrients come out of those capillaries on the arterial side of the capillaries. And it comes back into the capillaries on the venule side to be taken back to the heart through our good old friend, osmotic pressure.
Whoop woo! Yes. Did you ever watch that cartoon called Osmotic Jones or Osmosis Jones or something like that? It's a cracker. It's really good.
Yeah.
I'm going to send it to you. And recommendation for the listeners as well.
Nice. So we have about 5 litres of blood, give or take, in our body. And over the course of one day, because obviously blood just doesn't go around your body once in one day, it's continuously going around. 20 litres of fluid passes through these capillaries in your body in one day, but only 17 litres get reabsorbed. What happens to the other 3 litres, I hear you say? That's your lymph, yo! That's your lymph!
Oh, hey!
That's your lymph. So hanging out all around these blood vessel capillaries are your lymph capillaries, okay? Which are just as tiny, teeny tiny, one cell thick. And the structure of these lymphatic capillaries mean that fluid can only go into the capillaries and not out. So whereas your blood system, so all these capillaries and everything, is a closed network system, so it just keeps going round in one circle, you know, you don't break it like a hula hoop, essentially. The lymphatic capillaries aren't, so they end at the point where they're all around the capillary. So they're just hanging out all around there, and they suck up all this extra fluid, that is extra 3 litres around your body within a day, that don't get taken back into the venule side of those capillaries, and they take it back to the heart. This is why when you ever have something like a lymphatic massage or you do body brushing and things like that, you always go towards the heart because you're helping that lymph flow. Because what's really important about it is that the lymphatic system doesn't have a pump like our other circulatory system. We've got a big old heart, yeah? So that heart is pumping the blood around. The way that it starts to come back is there's a really thin layer of smooth muscle that lines these lymphatic vessels. And also it reacts to the nearby arteries. You know, you've got your pulse. We all know what a pulse is, right? We can all measure that quite easily. So part of that pulse, that movement, is what helps get the lymph back up towards the heart. Another huge part of that is our skeletal muscles. So we've got, obviously, muscles throughout our whole body. And when we move, that helps pump the lymph back. This is one of the reasons why it's so damn important to not sit on your ass all day and do nothing. Because if you don't, you're going to struggle to get your lymph back. So making sure you move and shake around. Go for a little walk. That's why your Fitbit vibrates every hour to say, hey, have you done your 250 steps yet? Go do those steps. So moving on to its second function, there are some things that are just too big to squeeze through those arterial capillaries. So thinking the capillaries are all one cell thick and they've got these tiny little gaps in between them. Some things like your red blood cells won't get through, things like hormones, some stuff like that just sometimes cannot get through. So part of this is that your lymphatic system mops up all this stuff that can't get through the capillary beds and takes that back up to the heart that then puts it into the heart and then can take it out to the rest of the bloodstream. It's very clever, very, very clever. The final function of the lymphatic system is my fave. Whilst all this fluid is travelling through the lymphatic system, it's being checked out. So they're surveilling, doing the surveillance, all the little CCTV and stuff, to check out, making sure there's no like baddies, none of the invader baddies that are coming into it. So we're talking things like virus, bacteria, you know, all these things, cells that have created a little bit evilly and all that stuff that needs to be taken out. And so within your lymphatic system, you've got these things called lymph nodes, which are essentially like little checkpoints, unfiltered lymph that carries to the lymph nodes. And the lymph node point is like this little checkpoint where things get filtered. And so you've got loads of different types of cells that do various different things that we won't go into too much detail about today, but they check for all these nasty bugs and invaders that might have gotten into the body. And particular cells will eat these things up and like kind of kill the bugs off, that sort of thing. Or in some cases, it will send an alert to the wider immune system to get that your full immune system to kick something into the body. So making sure that we're getting rid of all the bad stuff. So this is one of the reasons, again, why it's really important to keep your lymphatic system moving. Because if you've got all this lymph that's just like stuck around and not moving, because you just say you get up in the morning, you go and sit in your car, you drive to work, you get out your car, you sit at your desk all day, you go back to your car, you drive home, you come back home, you sit on the sofa, eat dinner, watch TV, and then you go to bed. That's not enough movement for you. And so that's one of the things, is that your lymph nodes aren't getting through all of that lymph properly in order for it to check and make sure you're being all super healthy and stuff. It's really important. It's where you can get things like edema. If you've heard of edema, it's where sometimes your legs can swell up and stuff. Your legs are swelling up. You've got to walk around more. It's really important to help get that lymph back up to the top of the body. Or do a yoga pose called Legs Up the Wall, or Vaparita Karani, if you would like the Sanskrit term, which is where literally you put your legs up a wall for 5 minutes at the end of each day. It's super relaxing. It's very easy to fall asleep in that pose. And it's really good at helping. Just let gravity do the work for you. If you really can't be bothered to go for a 20-minute walk every day, just put your legs up the wall and let gravity do the work for you. Let it come back.
I'm sorry, but I would definitely accidentally kick someone or something or someone like that doing that.
It's all good.
I think I'm safe for walking. Sticking to my runs.
So let's talk about some of those other organs from the lymphatic system. So first of all, you've got your spleen, and your spleen sits, it's just kind of sort of at the top to the left of the stomach, and it's made up of what they refer to as white and red pulp, and the white pulp is essentially acting like a giant lymph node, and the red pulp is where old blood cells go to be broken down. So red blood cells live for about kind of roughly about 3 months, and when they've done their life cycle, they've done their duty, they'll go over to the spleen where they get broken down and that stuff gets recycled. It also has an extra store of red blood cells and platelets. So in an emergency, you've cut yourself and you're bleeding. Your spleen's like, don't worry, guys, I've got a backup supply. And now it goes and sends it all out. So essentially, your spleen is super handy in an emergency. That's in regards to any invaders that are coming in. You've cut yourself. So it's like, let's not overlook the spleen and give it Give it a nice little bit of love.
Yeah, I feel like it gets a lot of hate, doesn't it? The spleen.
Mm. The thymus. It's lived slash lives, which will become more clear shortly, in the chest area. And it's mainly utilised when you're a tiny human or an adolescent. Once you've passed your adolescence and you become a full-blown adult, it begins to atrophy, which means it kind of shrinks, starts to get smaller, and it turns into a fatty tissue.
Delicious. Yum.
It's involved in the development of T cells, which are part of what helps your body create those antigens for all the invading bugs. Also your tonsils. Now we all know what tonsils are. We're all very, very familiar with tonsils. Mm. Some of you might not be, because some of you might not have them anymore. We know that they're in the back of the throat, and we know that when you start to get ill, they're sore and they flare up, right? It's one of those signs of illness, essentially. And that's because it's got something it's dealing with. You've got some form of bug that's coming in. But essentially, the way the tonsils are, they are a kind of ring around your throat. And they're a sort of a first sign of defense for invaders that are coming from foods you eat or the air that you inhale. One final thing on the lymphatic system that I think is really easy is you've got these kind of clusters of lymph nodes as well, which are generally quite easy to feel because they can range from about a couple of millimeters to a couple of centimeters wide. So that's why, like, if you're ill, you know, you've got a bit of bug and you go and see the doctor and they start to feel around your throat and things like that, because they, if your lymph nodes are inflamed, it means they're fighting something. They've got something to deal with. So that's why you get these things checked. And a couple of areas in which these things accumulate are, first of all, in your inguinal region. So that's just kind of on the sort of inside part of your groin area. So you've got some groups there. And also in your armpits and your neck again. That's why doctors test it. And in your left armpit, that area there is your huge waste disposal unit of the body. So with that, it drains all of the lymph that comes from both of your legs, your torso and your left arm, and the left side of your head all go to your left armpit. Whereas the ones in your right armpit drains everything from your right arm and the right side of your head. So your right armpit is chilly, chill, chill. It's having a really nice time. Your left armpit is kind of the one that's doing all the work, which I think is quite interesting, which I haven't found out if anyone knows why yet, because, you know, structure function, why is it the left side? I'd be very interested to know. But yeah, so that's why it's important. Check those lymph nodes, make sure they're not inflamed, make sure you're walking a lot, drink plenty of water, help your old lymphatic system out because it deserves a big old pat on the back.
Nice. Not one.
So V, what we're talking about today.
Osteopathy. You know, part of our little shindig here is the fact that we're osteopathy students. And actually, it's such a complex subject, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really complex and very up for very much debate as well by the looks of things at the moment.
Yeah.
Which makes it even that much more difficult whilst we're learning about it.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways around the world that osteopaths treat, which is only natural, isn't it? I mean, it would be a bit too simple if everyone did it the same way and had the same opinions. Also, boring.
True that.
Gonna throw that out. I love hearing other people's opinions about stuff. So it's interesting to see that there are these super, super traditional osteopaths who are still sort of word to word, word by word, listening to what AT still said and the original osteopaths and how to treat people. And then on the other scale, there's people who want to be more medicine, evidence-based, and more like physiotherapists.
Mm. And see, in my opinion, I'm like, put your hands together. What have you got? You've got the perfect osteopathy sandwich. But
I agree.
But apparently, you can only be one or the other. You can't be a combination of the two, which to me seems ludicrous.
I'm really not very good at being told what to do, so good luck to anyone telling me that I have to be one or the other.
Yeah, good luck. Because it's the thing, you can be really well informed by reading all the research and making sure you study real hard and whatever else and understanding what's going on in the world, but you can also have a very patient-centric approach to your treatment. You
know exactly.
What I mean? That's what I think.
Yeah.
But hey, I'm only a second-year student, so who knows?
What do we know? I'm sure if there's any actual osteopaths listening right now, they'll be like, girls, you don't even know the half of it. You just wait. And if that is the case, I look forward to knowing more. And if you'd like to discuss anything with us or send us some interesting articles or etc., Please do. Our email, doublesospodcast@gmail.com. But what we wanted to talk about today was narrative in osteopathy, because we've had a lesson yesterday, which is sort of essentially about the philosophy about being an osteopath. And it was a really interesting lecture, wasn't it, Chels?
Yeah, it was super, super interesting. And I quite liked it. And it kind of made me emote. I say this because I'm actually a robot that doesn't have feelings.
With the opposite.
Yeah, I'm literally just like, feelings. But yeah, I don't know, it made me feel kind of warm and fuzzy inside.
Everyone has their own healthcare concerns and issues and stuff like that. So we've had our fair share already of experiences with different healthcare practitioners, and those interactions and how they made you feel as a patient. And maybe now, as we're on this journey to becoming osteopathic practitioners, on what we would have done differently, or trying to see it from their point of view, it's an interesting way for us to learn to be better practitioners.
Today, we want to talk about narrative-based medicine, don't we?
Yeah,
I found it like a really interesting topic, where it's talking about how you have patients that want to tell their story. And obviously, as osteopaths, we're taking a full case history. Like, we want a lot of information from the patient, not just in regards to their physical ailments, but we're talking biopsychosocial. So, you know, we want to talk about their bodies, we want to talk about their minds, we want to talk about their worlds around them. So we want to take a lot of information. And I think, I mean, I know, V, like, we talked about this earlier today, I've had the same about when I've been trying to talk, this isn't necessarily an osteopath, but a GP, you know, pharmacist, like anything like that, trying to talk about something, you get interrupted like quite quickly. And we were talking about basically don't interrupt him.
Yeah.
was the summary, wasn't it?
It's very interesting. Just from, we were literally studying this and talking about this yesterday on our online course, and this morning in my hearing test, the healthcare practitioner sort of rushed me in, started asking me loads of questions and filling out a form on her computer and not looking me in the face when I was talking. And she was also asking me, oh, so you're this age, like, it's a bit weird that you're in, like, blah, 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 blah. Are you having this, this, and this? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm having some tinnitus and all of that sort of stuff. And she was like, oh, do you have, like, asthma or hay fever or this, this, and this? And I was like, no, I don't have this. No, I don't have that. I'm perfectly healthy. I haven't had a cold. I haven't had any infections or anything. She's like, okay. And then undid what she literally clicked on the button ahead before I'd even spoken to say that I'd had those. And it's like, oh, wow, you were jumping ahead massively. Yeah. It sort of made me laugh, because it was both funny because we'd just been talking about it in uni, and it gave me a perspective into what not to do in future. And she was a perfectly lovely woman, but it's like, you're giving me a class A example of what not to do. So this is great. This is great stuff for me for future.
Definitely from my perspective, whenever I'm looking in some form of healthcare situation where I'm talking to a doctor or something like that, I'm so much more hyper aware. But like my partner Jack said that he gets this rash every now and again. And he went to a doctor, had it previously before, and he had said, oh, it's came up again. I used the rest of the cream that I had gotten before. And the doctor says to him, like, oh, that was quite insightful of you. And he was like, should I not have done that? He's like, no, it's great. Just normally people just turn up. And it's like, one, stop talking about other patients to another patient. and two, it's a little bit condescending the way that you're just kind of anticipating the fact that people aren't going to abuse their common sense and all this sort of thing, whatever else. It's like, people are coming to you because, one, we don't educate people in the UK about their bodies and how to take care of themselves when they're children, really. Just that stuff, like my mum's thing is like, germaline solves all problems. You've got a problem, you put some germaline on it. That's the thing. But yeah, you get those things from your mum or your dad or, you know, other guardians, parents, you know, whoever that you've got around you. But we don't teach kids about it. So they're like afraid. So they're going to go to GPs like, this doesn't feel quite right. What does this mean? Because we don't teach people about it. Yeah. So of course they're going to come to you for any tiny little things. People are scared.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if there was a consensus or a consensus done in a particular area of how many people, if they were having a certain type of symptom, went straight to the pharmacy or their local grocery store or something like that, bought paracetamol, ibuprofen, that sort of stuff. And then maybe after a week, if that didn't work, or after a couple of weeks, they went to the GP. And that was their, those are the two options. Like, they either suppress it with loads of painkillers and try and do something in that route. And then if that doesn't work, because you're just suppressing the pain, you're not actually fixing it, going to the GP.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I read about recently as well, is that patient education is really important, because you can look something up and be like, oh my God, I've got something really bad. Go to the GP and they just kind of dismiss your worries. And it's like, it's not that, it's this, take this, you know, come back if you've still got pain or whatever in a couple of weeks' time. But I think it's really important to be like, okay, let's talk about, right, what is it that's worrying you? Let's talk about all of that. Okay, I'm going to break it down for you. This sort of illness would be because you would find symptoms like this, like this, like this, or what you've got, what it sounds like to me is because X, Y, and Z is happening. It looks something like this. So I'm going to give you this, which what this tablet will do is this. And then it's going to take a couple of weeks to really take effect. If it's still like that, then something like that, that sort of discussion around providing them with more information, education, I think reduces the stress. And reducing stress is also super important for healing anyway, I think.
I totally agree. Totally agree. It'd be really interesting to see if, you know, when the leaflets are outside in like a waiting room and stuff like that, how many people actually read those and read something that they think has something to do with them and sort of take that on. And if they're given a diagnosis, which I like, how much they take that diagnosis into part of their like self that they think of themselves is like, I'm a mother, I like to have two children, I'm from this area, I'm this old, my job used to be this, and I have this condition. And it's like, that becomes part of them. And how much a diagnosis is, our lecturer actually said something that I thought was interesting. A diagnosis actually realistically more like a hypothesis.
And that's the first time I've ever heard anyone say that, because previously it's always been like, a diagnosis is concrete. That is it. You've been given your diagnosis. Yeah, on the topic of like narrative-based medicine, we were recommended to watch this TED Talk by Dr. Rita Sharon, I think is how you pronounce her name. And first of all, I want her to be my aunt or something. Do you know what I mean? It's just like she had just one of those, that sort of presence of like just being really calming, and just that you wanted to be around her. You wanted to be a GP, in a nutshell.
Ideal.
That's what you want. You want someone like her. And she said something that just completely stuck in my brain. I actually wrote down on a note. I'm just like, sticking that on my wall and I'm never going to forget it. And essentially she's, you know, she's a general practitioner in the United States. And she wanted to learn more about stories and why people tell their stories and things like that. So ended up doing a PhD in literature. The idea is that essentially healthcare professionals become really numb to health issues, essentially, because we're so used to seeing it all the time. You can completely numb to it. And she put those that are used to illness, numbed by illness, to open their springs of illustrative creativity.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Beautiful. And what she said that is, when she's got a new patient that comes to her, she says, I will be your doctor, so I need to know a great deal about you, your body, and your life. Please tell me what you think I need to know about your situation. How amazing is that?
Spot on.
As a patient, to go to someone and hear that would be incredible. I think half of that is just like, someone actually wants to listen to what I've got to say. And she talked a lot about some of the different responses, and sometimes she gets like, you need to hear me talk. That's one of the things. So another patient had started talking about some sort of trauma that they had, that they had gone through, emotional trauma within their family, and started to cry. And then said, he was like, you're the first person that's ever asked me this. Just having that presence and that knowing that I'm here to talk to you, I'm here to care about you, is really, really powerful.
Yeah.
I think
it's so important to firstly provide a space that is open, but for that space to be safe, and for that person to feel safe that they're like, actually, this person does want to listen to me, and I know that they are going to want to listen to me, and potentially they might not have all of the answers that I want, but just somebody listening to you is such an extremely powerful and important thing to be able to give someone, is listening space.
Mm. There was something else that someone was saying, that there was a study of, I think it was like 325 people, and where they were being, their sort of patient consultations were being watched, essentially. 80% of patients were able to voice all of their concerns with 2 minutes of uninterrupted talking. 2 minutes.
Wow.
That's it. And it was only 7 people out of 325 that needed over 5 minutes.
Wow. That's really amazing, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's like, you know, sometimes people are going to go, sometimes people are talkers, right? Mm. They want to chat a little bit. They want to, you know, talk about their cat and their pals, you know, Sally or something, and how they had a nice cup of tea and a bit of cake the other week. But that also then, as osteopaths looking at the biopsychosocial model, shows us, is first of all, that's telling us about her environment, her social environment.
Yeah.
She's got a mate that she goes to meet up with every week for a cup of tea. Amazing. That's great. She's got a support system around her.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And tells us more about her personality, tells us more about her mental state. It's like, let them talk. And that was another thing. I always write down like quotes from lecturers whilst I'm like writing down my notes. And one of the things that I drew a little box around was like, listen to your patients. They are telling you the diagnosis.
Ooh, those are good.
Which I think is really important. Really, really good.
Going back to what you were saying about the biopsychosocial and the social element, it might be a bit confusing to some people when they're going to see an osteopath and that osteopath is asking them about their social circumstances, and they're not meaning like, oh, did you go out last Friday night, and like, where did you go out, that's the stuff, what did you wear. They're like, they want to know if you have a support system around you, because support systems can make or break how somebody's treatment plan can go.
Mm.
If somebody's supporting you, whether it's acute pain or chronic pain or conditions or anything like that, that it makes a huge difference, and your osteopath wants to know if you have a support system behind you or whether they can fill part of that support system for you more so than they would for somebody who had loads of people to support them. Like there definitely needs to be a space when they're coming in, when patients are coming in for treatment, that they need that space even more to talk about their pain or what they're going through, because they don't have anyone else to talk about that with, which definitely. I absolutely love that.
Me too. Oh, it makes me feel, see, I said warm, I got the feels.
I always had the feels. Yeah, we would love to know as well about your experiences with all sorts of healthcare practitioners, whether they're osteopaths or any of the other professions. And that is as a practitioner or as a patient, we would love to know interactions that have been meaningful for you, either in a positive or negative way. If you want to talk to them with us, then we would absolutely love that, because we would love to hear more about what makes or breaks interactions between patients and practitioners.
Alternative therapy time.
Sorry, but this has to happen every episode now. Little gospel alternative therapies moment. I mean, we could go all through the genres.
We could, yeah. Like death metal, alternative therapy.
I love that so much.
I think I nailed it, I'm not gonna lie.
I think you did too. That's why I was tickled with pink.
I am crying a little bit now.
I have that effect on people.
We're going to talk about Reiki today.
Ooh, Reiki.
So this is something I really didn't know a lot about at all before I started looking into it. And I'm intrigued by it, very intrigued. Because, as always, with all alternative therapies, there's loads of scientists that are like, you can't prove this with science, so therefore it doesn't exist. But then also there are a lot of people that's like, but I really like it and I feel really good. So I think it's like one of those, I find these topics really fascinating.
Yeah.
Because, I think it's like, feeling's important, isn't it?
It is.
It's good.
And I feel like both you and I are pretty open books to learning about everything and anything. We want to know about it. We want to experience it for ourselves so that we can make up our own minds. We're not easily led people, are we?
No. So we're going to delve into Reiki today. I've had a few people mention it to me before, and I think some people maybe have talked to me about it without using the term Reiki, maybe use like energy healing or something.
Mm.
But I think it is quite interesting. It's a form of alternative therapy that's commonly referred to as energy healing. And it emerged in Japan in, I've got here, the late 1800s. I don't know how true that is, because some places say it's thousands of years old, some places say it's hundreds of years old, but...
Yeah.
In the form that it exists now, they're saying late 1800s, okay? And it involves in the transfer of universal energy from the practitioner's palms to their patient.
Okay.
Reiki practitioners use this technique called palm healing or hands-on healing, through which a universal energy is said to be transferred through the palms of the practitioner to the patient. And it's generally used to encourage emotional or physical healing.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, of course, there is some controversy around it because it's not easy to prove, but it is rapidly growing in popularity at the moment. The UK Reiki Federation says Reiki's gentle energy is easily adapted to most medical conditions and may be used safely by people of all ages, including pregnant mothers, newborns, surgical patients, the frail, and elderly in any situation. Being complementary, Reiki works effectively alongside orthodox healthcare and natural remedies, expanding treatment options. I really liked that because it's talking about working alongside other therapies and just providing something additional. It's not saying like, this is the only way forward, this is the only thing, the right way to do something. It's like, it works really well alongside everything else.
Yeah, so, they're a team player.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I was like, I really appreciate that. And I think that's good. So Reiki itself doesn't have its own regulatory body in the UK, but practitioners are recommended to register with either the Complementary and Natural Health Council or the General Regulatory Council for Complementary Therapies. So there is, you know, it does look like it's really good. The UK Reiki Federation website has got loads of really good information. They talk about lots of CPD and all this stuff, and very much keeping to the lineage of it as much as possible and really making sure that practitioners keep up to date with information, which I think is really important. So this is one thing I like. You know, like how we've been breaking down all those anatomy words?
Mm.
We're going to break down Reiki. And I was like, oh, this is so lovely. So it comes from the Japanese words rei, which means universal, and ki, which is life energy. Reiki.
Okay. Like chi is life energy in China.
Literally that.
Okay.
It is chi, based on the flow of chi around the body. And the same as that it's called prana within Ayurveda and yoga. It's the same thing, just slightly different name.
Interesting.
So the theory is that this energy can stagnate in the body where there's been physical injury or possible emotional pain. And in time, these energy blockages can cause illness. So it's quite similar to a lot of the theory behind like a lot of other therapies we've talked about as well, that there's this energy within the body and it gets blocked and like built up and we need to release it. So Reiki aims to unblock these areas and improve the flow of energy in a similar way to acupuncture or acupressure.
Ooh, interesting.
Yes, which obviously you've talked about a lot before. So dear listener, if you haven't listened to that episode where V's been talking about acupuncture, I'd go back and have a little listen because it's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
So the whole aim is that this can enable relaxation, reduce pain, speed up healing and reduce symptoms of illness. What takes place in a session? Sessions are generally held in a really calm and peaceful setting, and this can be sort of anywhere. There's, you know, it doesn't have to be somewhere specific. It can be in the patient's home, it can be in a clinic, whatever works for them. And the patient can either sit in a chair or they can lay down, and they're always fully clothed. The practitioner will place their hands lightly on or over a specific area of the head, limbs, torso, and they use different hand shapes. And it's roughly they keep their hands there for about 2 to 5 minutes. The hands can be placed over 20 different areas in the body. And in some cases, hands will be held like just above the wound rather than touching the body. So say if they've got something like a burn or something like that, you don't want to put direct pressure onto it, so they hold it just above. Each hand position is held until the practitioner senses that the energy has stopped flowing. So there's obviously some form of something that the practitioner knows about, that they can tell that the energy has stopped flowing. So some of the techniques that they use, they've got lots of different names. So you've got things like centering, clearing, beaming, extracting harmful energies, infusing, and smoothing and raking the aura. And Anne Harrington, who is the chair of the Reiki Federation in the UK, said that Reiki relies on no other instruments beyond the practitioner. We do not use crystals, powders, or wands as a general rule. However, one of the benefits of Reiki healing is distance healing, where Reiki is sent over several miles. Then many practitioners will use crystals to assist with the energy vibrations. So I don't really know too much about this in terms of, because obviously they're talking about before where it's like the hands of the practitioner is being placed over an area specifically to, you know, to release and, you know, this flow of energy or anything. Yeah. But over a distance and several miles, this is where for me I'm a little bit like, how? How does this work? Do you know what I mean? We'd be interested to know more about that if anyone does know any more about that. Sessions can last between 15 to 90 minutes. The 90-minute ones are normally like your first consultation, where they're taking more about, you know, talking about you and your history and things like that. So the energy is said to permeate the body, whereas Reiki experts point out that, well, the energy is not, it can't be measured, right, by science or by scientific techniques. It can be felt by many who tune into it. So it aids relaxation and it assists in the body's natural healing processes, which I think for us as osteopaths is very important to be aware of, because this is one of our key principles. Yeah. Like the body is its own medicine chest. And one thing that we're doing as osteopaths is to help the body naturally heal itself. So this is why I think it's something that's really interesting for us, and to be more aware of it. It can help develop emotional, mental and spiritual well-being as well. It's very relaxing. Loads of people say that they feel really relaxed, they fall asleep during the process, and just really helps to relieve stress and improve overall well-being. Individuals report loads of different experiences. Some say that practitioners' hands become hot, others say that the hands become cold, some people feel pulsating waves, but like I said, the most common reports are generally of a release of stress and really deep relaxation. Some of the conditions that are commonly used to treat are cancer, heart disease, anxiety, depression, chronic pain, infertility, neurodegenerative disorders, autism, Crohn's disease, and fatigue syndromes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought this was quite interesting, especially from the cancer perspective. And so I did a little bit more digging, and it turns out that Reiki is very, very popular around cancer patients looking for an alternative treatment. So not necessarily alternative, it's definitely complementary in terms of they're still keeping up with their more orthodox treatment, but using this in addition to it. Obviously, there's currently very little scientific evidence that says it helps treat or cures cancer. There are even cancer clinics that provide it as part of treatment, the patient's treatment plan, and you can even get it on the NHS.
Oh, you can?
Yeah.
That's really surprising to me.
Isn't it? Yeah, I thought it was very surprising. But cancer patients who have Reiki generally all report saying that they feel better because it helps them relax. And yeah. I think that this is really important and not something to be taken lightly, is again, like we were talking about earlier, relaxing, turning on that parasympathetic nervous system is so, so, so important for healing. If you're stressed, your body is not going to be able to heal itself properly. So I think having that time that you're spending time with the patient, you're there having that physical contact with another human being, is not something to be overlooked or dismissed lightly, I think. If it's helping a patient heal, it's making them feel better, then we need to understand that that has weight to a patient's recovery, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really amazing that it's had such a profound response from cancer patients as well, to say that it works. Because I'm sure if you were in that position and you were looking for complementary treatments to go along with what you're already doing, something that is like been told to you by actual people who've gone through this, that it's relaxing, that must be like a real like golden nugget to look for.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, again, that human contact thing is that when we're babies and children, we get touched all the time, right? You know, you've always got a parent or a parent's friend or someone else like holding you. Everyone wants to hold the baby. They always want to hug the children and whatever else. The older we get, the less we're touched.
Mm.
And especially people that live by themselves, you know, especially in this climate that we're existing at the moment in terms of COVID and everything, you're very less likely to be touched. And I think that has a huge effect on people. And, you know, just in terms of the release of oxytocin within the body and things like that, I think it's really, really important. So, yeah, that's my kind of introduction into Reiki, and I'm really interested by it. And, you know, I think I might even go and give it a go and come back to you and let you know my thoughts.
Yeah, I think I'd be really interested in getting it done as well.
First of all, there's something I need from you, which is the jingle.
Medical story time!
Yes. Second of all, I'm fucking scared. I'm not going to lie. I'm afraid because the last 2 weeks, I've put some dark, twisted,
dark,
horrible stories.
You've taken us down a dark route.
I really have.
So last week, we spoke about how much we dislike dentistry work in general. Not dentists. We don't hate you. We just don't massively. We're not fond of the procedures that you do. So I thought, why not talk about America's most famous dentist called Painless Parker, a.k.a. Edgar Randolph Parker.
He's full of shit. I can already feel it.
He's full of shit. So over his career, Parker had dozens of offices spread between Utah, California, Oregon, New York, all over the place. But he began his career in New Brunswick, his hometown province. At the time, regular checkups weren't a thing, so to encourage people to come to him, he offered to extract anyone's tooth for 50 cents. And he armed himself with a syringe of watered down cocaine he christened Hydrocaine. I know. And he promised extraction would be completely painless and offered $5 to any patient who wasn't satisfied.
He's fucking full of shit. He's full of shit.
I mean, you're armed with Hydrocaine, mate.
Jesus Christ.
Hydrocaine. I'm sure there would be a little bit less pain because people are going to be fucking off their tits.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, unsurprisingly, the narcotic did its job, and soon he was making money as a travelling dentist, borrowing a rocking chair for his patients wherever they went, which really disturbed me. A rocking chair. There should be no rocking about this.
Unless he's just like, oh yeah, do you know what? Who cares what fucking tooth we take out today? It's just going to be this geese. Because it's just like this sort of...
It's not a pick and mix of teeth to pull out. I mean, that's fucking gross. Nobody wants that. That's like, I don't know, what's the shittest pick and mix bit?
The licorice ones.
Oh, yeah, fucking hate licorice.
Yeah.
Fucking hate licorice. They're the licorice of this situation. So some years later, he and his family moved to New York, where he struggled again until he met William Beebe, or Beebe. Whatever that is, a former employer of P.T. Barnum, which we of course know from beautiful films like, what's it called? It's the one with Hugh Jackman.
What, the Greatest Showman?
That's the one, The Greatest Showman.
I haven't seen it, but...
You haven't?
No, I'm a bit shit with films recently.
See, I can never gauge where you would actually like it.
I don't know, I'm a bit of a...
A movie snob.
Yeah, of course I'm fussy. Just, am I fussy? Am I easygoing? No.
No, I'm not.
Maybe I'll give it a go and I'll let you know my thoughts.
Yeah, I think you should. So he met William Beebe, the former employee of P.T. Barnum. So together they planned to do the unthinkable, which was brazenly advertise Parker and his skills to take on the road as an act.
As an act?
As an act.
Like a circus? Like a show?
Yeah, like a show, which...
Oh, no.
Okay. So out on the bustling streets, a musician or a brass band would play to draw attention. It's also provided great cover for patient screams, I reckon. Yeah, just that trumpet action. And Parker would give his well-practiced speech and offer to treatment to anyone. Anyone on the street. Children, adults, elderly, the lot.
Just like, so hey, you want a tooth pulling out? Come on down.
I'll take it. So customers soon filled his expanding offices. So he commissioned a Paris trap, is what it's called, which is a horse-drawn flatbed with a dentist's chair for his shows, and kept his ever-filling bucket of teeth close at hand for people to see.
No.
Gross! A bucket of teeth! I'm sorry.
I'm going to call you in the middle of the night when I have a nightmare about a bucket of teeth. Like, it's inevitable.
It's so scary. So despite his undoubted dental proficiency, because apparently he was a good dentist, apparently he had a whole clientele who raved about how good he was. His maverick showmanship saw him endlessly dismissed as a quack and a charlatan by many. So he regularly fought in the courts against limits on advertising and his legitimacy. And the ethics, but also overcharging and monopolies. Parker always kept his prices affordable for his poor clients, though, so don't worry about that.
Good old Ed, isn't he? Good Ed.
I know. But after BB's sudden death, Parker moved to California. Eventually, he set up the Institute of Dental Economics to train dentists and fight his many legal battles with the California State Dental Association. He was askewed on an office full of costly rugs and pictures in favour of new technology, and he offered mouthwashes, toothpastes and powders for brushing at home. Bearing in mind, this was for the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Do people not brush their teeth then?
I think they were, but he was offering it as like a, you really need to be doing this for your dental health.
Wait, are you telling me he's actually a good guy?
I think he actually was.
Oh, no. I was just like, he's obviously a prick.
I actually think he did care about people's dental health. He just had a very strange way of showing it.
Yeah.
So in 1913, Parker bought a travelling circus and became a ringmaster. On one notable day, he claimed to have extracted over 350 teeth. Which he, of course, I mean, why wouldn't you, wore on a necklace. While non-patients could see the elephants, watch the performers or ogle at the tattooed lady. And I have seen a picture of an elephant with, like, the Painless Parker, like, advertisement on the side. So as, like, a banner.
It was, like, a huge kind of performance thing. That yeah. was going on. So it'd just be like, you know, your whole family going, I was like, it's all right, we'll watch the elephants, you can get your teeth on, mate.
Which is, it's so, so interesting. So eventually concerns about bacteria and sterilisation led Parker to give up his sidewalk demonstration, which I can't say that I'm too sorry for him about. So while he switched out for screening educational films about oral care in his office. So that's what he ended up switching to try and, like, entice people in.
I'm feeling so really conflicted about this man.
I know! And interested crowds were then invited to come next door for a free checkup. If they were, like, if you're going to watch his educational film, why not come for a free checkup? It sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? So in 1915, he legally changed his first name to Painless. From Edgar, which I don't blame him. I mean, Edgar's a great name, it's fine, but Painless is it's a bit badass, isn't it? Because he was accused of breaking a false advertisement law by claiming that his dentistry was truly painless. This is why he actually changed his name, though.
Yeah. Sneaky.
So his businesses actually did thrive, and he hired lots of employees and assistants and established a chain of dentistry businesses. And in the end, Painless Parker ran 28 dental offices, employing over 70 dentists and grossing $3 million per year.
Wow.
Yeah.
$3 million per year in the late 1800s.
Yes, early 1900s.
An obscene amount of money.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? So this is the confusing, but extremely interesting career of Painless Parker, the most famous American dentist.
That is mental. I was literally getting ready. I was so geared up to hate him. But now I feel conflicted.
Yeah. It both because the last couple of episodes we've mentioned about dentistry and the sort of behaviour around like pulling teeth as like the source of like mental disturbances and infections and blockages to health and stuff like that. So it's sort of in the same period of time where people were removing teeth to prevent conditions from occurring was the same time that Painless Parker was actually trying to educate people on their oral hygiene and supplying free checkups and actually trying to educate people and provide them with healthcare for their teeth and oral hygiene, but he was just doing it in a very strange way.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Especially where we've been talking about narrative and it's like, I mean, he got his point far and wide from his narrative.
He did indeed.
I mean, we're still talking about it today.
Exactly. Exactly.
Good job. But,
Yeah, I think when you're mixing a lot of money plus showmanship and extravagant actions and behaviours and all of that sort of stuff in with medicine and hygiene, it does seem like a bit too polar opposite to be really comfortable altogether. But that's what they loved, isn't it? I mean, if you're bringing in loads of people to get free checkups so that you can provide them with dentistry work and mouthwash and toothpaste and toothbrushes, then if it's working and people are doing better, is that a good thing?
Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm feeling we're leaving you in a bit more upbeat than last week, so
woohoo! I mean, don't go and put like a dentistry show outside your house or something like that, especially during these times.
Yeah.
I think it's probably a miss now.
Definitely.
And I mean, if you saw somebody with teeth on a necklace, I'd steer clear, to be honest.
Yeah, I would run the other way. Probably call the police.
Yeah.
If you would like to talk to us about anything from this episode today or get in touch with us to talk about anything you want or want us to talk about something, you can drop us a message on any of our social media platforms. We are at TTOOS Podcast on all of the Twitters, the Instagrams, the whatnots. Or if you want to send us an email to TTOOSpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for listening and we'll speak to you next week.
We'll see you next week. Bye.